raid on a refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Russia says Ukraine has carried out new drone attacks on its Black Sea Navy base. And China warns NATO plans to expand to the Asia-Pacific region. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Israel's deadly violence against Palestinians shows no signs of abating as the regime forces fatally shoot another Palestinian teen in the occupied West Bank. The victim has been identified as 18-year-old Mahmoud Abu Hussan. The Palestinian boy was shot in the head during an Israeli raid on a refugee camp east of the city of Tulkarm. He later succumbed to his wounds in the hospital. Israeli troops carry out regular attacks against Palestinians across the occupied territories almost on a daily basis. The regime has killed more than 200 Palestinians during its West Bank raid since the start of this year. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kendall, tells us more about the late deadly Israeli raid on the Tulkarm refugee camp.
Israeli forces have raided the Tulkarm refugee camp northern the occupied West Bank early Friday in order to conduct arrests among Palestinians. The Israeli military claims that Palestinians in that area, in Tulkarm, specifically in the refugee camp of Tulkarm itself, had been engaged in shootings at Israeli military checkpoints and near the illegal Israeli settlements. And also Palestinians there continue to throw stones and Molotov cocktails at the Israeli military vehicles. When the Israeli soldiers were pulling out from the refugee camp of Tulkarm, they opened fire at the Palestinians who rushed to the area and clashed with the Israeli forces in the nearby or the adjacent refugee camp of Nur Shemes. 18-year-old Mahmoud Abu Hussan was shot directly in the head. Palestinian paramedics said that Mahmoud Abu Hussan was shot in the head. He was transferred to Tulkarm Hospital. Then he succumbed to his wounds. Palestinian resistance groups said its fighters or their fighters, a number of Palestinian resistance groups said their fighters in the Tulkarm refugee camp clashed with Israeli forces, and that they also said they will continue to resist the Israeli forces and do their utmost in order to prevent and to stop this daily Israeli aggression against the Palestinians, and they will continue to fight the Israelis until bringing the Israeli occupation to an end.
Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, the vulnerability of Israel's spy agencies has come to light once again. Now the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement says it has managed to infiltrate the regime's secret services. Al-Quds Brigades, which is the Islamic Jihad's armed wing, says it has successfully penetrated the Mossad and Shin Bet spy agencies by sending in six undercover members of its own security apparatus. Al-Quds Brigades added that its undercover members managed to infiltrate the recruitment and spy management systems of the regime's intelligence services. It said a number of Israeli officers were trapped through deception operations and revealed secrets of the regime's security systems, intelligence procedures, and also spying tools. To discuss that further, we're joined by Moti Abu Musabe, Palestinian political activist who's joining us live from Gaza City. Also, we have with us Wafa Al-Udaini, Palestinian activist and journalist, also from Gaza City. Let's begin with Muti Abu Musabe. Now, this is quite an interesting piece of news, a regime that tries to show, to portray the image of being invincible now has so easily been infiltrated.
Okay, first of all, thanks for having me. It's worth mentioning that Palestinian resistance factions actually are in the middle of an old and continuous security agencies. And this is not today. From time, the Palestinian resistance actually are in an open confrontation with the Palestinian resistance are in the middle of the confrontation with the Israeli security agencies, and this is a vital part of the general battle and the general struggle of the Palestinian people against the Israeli operations and aggressions targeting Palestinian civilians, because the Palestinian resistance actually understands clearly that this is a vital part for the Israeli occupation forces to conduct their operations against the Palestinian people. So the Palestinian resistance factions find themselves obliged to take measures on this side in order to prevent the Israeli from having or from conducting any aggressions against the Palestinian people. This is on one hand. On the other hand, it's not the first time for the Palestinian resistance to record the scores against the Israeli security agents. And on the ground, many agents who are engaged with the security activities on the ground were captured by the Palestinian resistance. So this reveals clearly that the Palestinian resistance are trying to develop itself in the security side in order to deter the Israeli occupation or to prevent the Israeli occupation from conducting or committing more crimes against the Palestinian people.
Okay, so let's bring in Wafa Al-Udaini. Your opinion, what message does send to the world?
Yeah, again, actually, this operation debunks the myth about the Palestinian freedom fighters, that they are terrorist people who want to wipe out Israel out of the map. Now, we according to this operation, they prove that they are freedom fighters and that they can, debunk the myth that the whole world to prove that those people are just terrorists who need to be killed by the Israeli forces. And as Motia said, this is not the first time for the Palestinian resistance from fighter to infiltrate the spy system of the occupation authorities. Now we can say that the Palestinian freedom fighters that they can use, that they like to use all the ways possible to defend their people from the occupation, oppression, and subjugation. As you know, that the Palestinian people are subject to daily oppression and subjugation by this occupation. So, of course, they want to defend themselves, they want to defend their people, and because they deep inside believe in their right to exist in this country and that this country is theirs, so that's why they do not immigrate or they do not go anywhere and just leave their people here and just leave this country for the Israelis. They just, use the same mechanism that the Israeli regime use against them. And you know that the Israeli occupation agency services, they many times actually use the intelligence the artificial intelligence just to kill and to murder the Palestinian freedom fighters, in particular in occupied West Bank and also in the Gaza Strip. So the freedom fighters here and the resistance here use the same mechanism, you know, because, you know, like they have only simple, you know, equipment. And we can say that, you know, like that the Israeli occupation forces they have, they are considered like the most, one of the most powerful spy agencies in the world. And you know, like this is considered like a successful conduct by those freedom fighters to infiltrate the spy agencies of the occupation, and then to prove that they can collect any information that they want from the occupation. So the message, again, I just want to confirm to the world that those people are not terrorist people who want just to, you know, to conduct like suicide bombing or to kill Israelis or anything else. They have nothing to do with that. They are just freedom fighters who seek indeed to live in their occupied land freely, because like the whole world actually just they feel disappointed from the whole world and even the international community, like because like many times they were like the Israeli occupation committed crimes and massacres and atrocity against the Palestinian people. It becomes like a daily basis, and no one do anything, you know, just to stop this occupation. So the Palestinian people, again, it proves that they are educated people, that they are cultured people who just use the intelligence, the artificial intelligence, for their favor to free their land from this occupation and from this oppression.
Thank you very much, Moti Abu Musabe, Palestinian political activist, also Wafa Al-Udaini, also activist and journalist, both joining us from Gaza City. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has denounced the United States' meddlesome policy as the root cause of problems in the region. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah attributed Washington's interference in regional affairs to its relentless pursuit of hegemony over the countries. He highlighted the coercive strategies employed by the U.S., which have inflicted considerable hardships on regional nations, including Syria and Yemen. Nasrallah called for a united stance against Washington's hegemony to hold it accountable for the crises that have plagued the region. The Hezbollah chief also addressed the recent clashes in a Palestinian camp in southern Lebanon. He said Hezbollah has no involvement in those conflicts. He also emphasized that such violence only serves to undermine the path of resistance. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh joined us earlier from Beirut to weigh in on the recent speech by the Hezbollah chief.
In this speech, more than going into details, he was going more for the bigger picture. And so, therefore, this was part of his strategy also by confronting the United States and everything. Basically uncovering everything the United States is saying. The United States have promised Lebanon and Lebanon electricity, for example. They promised people in Iraq as well that they would solve the electricity crisis and so on and so forth, all these issues. But he said that these are false promises. It's been 2 years since the United States has promised Lebanon that they would allow the Egyptian gas to go through Jordan. Jordan would give us through Syria, of course, and they still have allowed this. So all of these were just false promises, just like they promised the Palestinian Authority that they would assist them in establishing an independent state. So therefore, this is part of Hezbollah's strategy that began, I believe, mostly right after the assassination and the martyrdom of Qasem Soleimani, that was when Sayyid Nasrallah took on a different rhetoric, not just only focusing on the confrontation with Israel, but going broader to the level of confronting the United States administration itself and its policies of tyranny in the region.
Russia has reported new Ukrainian drone attacks on the Crimean Peninsula as well as a Navy base in the Black Sea. Russia says its air defenses downed 10 drones over Crimea and suppressed 3 more with electronic countermeasures. In the Black Sea, Russia says Ukrainian drones attacked a Navy base near the port of Novorossiysk. This is one of the largest ports in the Black Sea and a major hub for Russian exports. The attack prompted the port to temporarily halt ship movement. Moscow says it has destroyed all Ukrainian drones. No damage or casualties were reported. The two warring sides have intensified drone strikes on each other's territories in recent weeks, including on their capital cities. China's ambassador to Russia has raised the alarm about the consequences of NATO's expansion to the Asia-Pacific region. He warned that such expansionist plans by Western military alliance will exacerbate tensions and provoke a new Cold War. He called on the military alliance to drop these plans, which can spur an arms race and rectify its erroneous attitude. The Chinese diplomat said NATO is seeking to ruin peace and tranquility in the Asia-Pacific region after misleading Europe, and what it is doing does not promote friendship and peace. He also said that NATO's drills in Asia-Pacific only fan tensions and create confrontation. He also accused the alliance of interfering in Asia-Pacific affairs. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Washington Post keeps cheerleading sending cluster bombs to Ukraine. According to reports, Washington Post has published 5 pieces in its opinion section that take a direct stance in favor of arming Ukraine with the US regime cluster munitions, and only one opposed to it. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Common Dreams wrote, "The Washington Post describes its opinion section as a platform for articles that provide a diversity of voices and perspectives for readers. Yet, as the U.S. and its allies pour military aid into Ukraine, escalating the already bloody conflict with ever more deadly new weapons, the paper's opinion pages begin to look less like a platform for diverse voices and more like a cheerleading squad for the military-industrial complex. Post-opinion journalism abounds with pieces advocating the sort of light side versus dark side, moral rhetoric characteristic of corporate media's war coverage. A consequence of this binary worldview is the tendency to present the deployment of increasingly horrific means, like President Joe Biden's recent decision to arm Ukraine with U.S. cluster munitions, as essentially just and necessary to achieve the West's always noble ends. Cluster munitions are a type of ordnance which can leave unexploded bomblets around for decades, almost 50 years after the end of the U.S. government's war of aggression against Laos. Unexploded cluster bombs continue to kill and maim innocent people, frequently children. These weapons are likely so reviled that shortly after Russia-Ukraine crisis in February 2022, then White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki responded to the possibility that Russia had already begun using cluster munitions against Ukraine by calling it potentially a war crime. Even so, U.S. regime cluster munitions have arrived in Ukraine and are now being used by Kiev. Advocating for escalation, a post-editorial headline, NATO's annual summit could define a decade of Western security, argued that NATO needs to step up their game. It called Biden's decision to arm Ukraine with cluster munitions a tough but correct call. The editorial board explained, their use is banned by some major NATO allies because dot bombs left behind on the battlefield pose a threat to civilians. The Biden administration is legally required to export only shells that have a very low dot rate. Some major allies. Out of the 31 NATO members, the U.S. finds company with only 7 others in its refusal to join the convention in cluster munitions. The editorial board cites the fact that the cluster munitions being sent by the U.S. regime have a very low dot rate and will therefore pose less of a risk to civilians. The Pentagon claims that the munitions it is sending have a dot rate of 2.35%. Even if that's accurate, it exceeds the 1% limit the Pentagon itself considers acceptable. According to the New York Times' John Ismay, a failure rate of 2.35% would mean that for every 2 shells fired, about 3 unexploded grenades would be left scattered on the target area. There is reason to believe that the true dot rate may be much higher, possibly exceeding 14% by the Pentagon's own reckoning. Another post op-ed by columnist Max Boot headlined, "Why Liberals Protesting Cluster Munitions for Ukraine Are Wrong," illustrates the ends justify the means rhetoric so pervasive in discourse over the war. Boot acknowledged the devastating impact of cluster munitions, noting that, in Laos alone, at least 25,000 people have been killed or injured by unexploded ordnance since the U.S. bombing ended, he added. Such concerns led more than 100 nations, but not the United States or Ukraine, to join the 2008 Convention on Cluster Munitions, abolishing the use of these weapons. Of course, the U.S. regime is notorious for isolating itself from the rest of the world when it comes to the signing of international treaties. As the Council on Foreign Relations, where Boot is a senior fellow, has shown, the U.S. regime signed out but failed to ratify the 1996 Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, which has 178 state parties, and the 1979 Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, which has 189 state parties. It refused to even sign the 1997 Mine Ban Treaty, which has 164 state parties. Boot cited the probability that the dot rate of U.S. cluster munitions is much higher than the given 2.35%, but immediately downplayed this fact on the basis that, in other words, the Ukraine government should be allowed to decide how many Ukrainian civilians are acceptable to kill. This is a dubious principle, even when you aren't talking about a war against separatists. In the areas where the weapons are likely to be used, a large minority to a majority of the population identifies as ethnically Russian. Boot claimed, using cluster munitions has the potential to save the lives of many Ukrainian soldiers. Despite the fact that these same U.S. munitions have a history of killing both civilians and U.S. personnel alike. Moreover, Booth argued cluster munitions remain a lawful instrument of warfare for countries that haven't signed the 2008 Convention, and Kyiv has shown itself a responsible steward of all the Western weaponry it has received. Setting aside international norms, even countries who have not joined the Cluster Munitions Convention must respect the Geneva Conventions, which prohibit indiscriminate attacks in civilian areas. That makes cluster munitions used in such areas illegal. Yet responsible steward, Ukraine has already used its own cluster munitions in the city of Izium, predictably resulting in civilian casualties.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. And the United States has announced a $345 million weapons package for Taiwan. The total package allotted this year will be $1 billion. And to expedite the delivery, Washington has used what is known as the presidential drawdown authority to pull the weapons and equipment directly from the inventory of the Department of Defense. Now, this procedure has only been used once before, and that was for Ukraine. The question is, why does Washington want to accelerate a conflict with Beijing? Just as Russia had stated that Ukraine was its red line, Beijing has told the United States that Taiwan is its red line and an integral part of China. Does Washington want war with Beijing? Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Ken Hammond, professor of East Asian and Global History at New Mexico State University, out of New Mexico. And William Jones, Washington Bureau Chief, Executive Intelligence Review, out of Washington, D.C. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let's start off with Ken. I mean, where do we begin, Ken? What happened to change the U.S.'s One China policy perspective? Let's start from there, which it had been adhering to more or less for decades.
Well, the shift really in American policy starts about, almost 15 years ago, certainly 12 years ago. The United States political elites had anticipated for a couple of decades that China was going to, as it reformed its economy, as it became more integrated with the global economic system, that China was going to go through a political transition, that the Communist Party would somehow be either overthrown or simply become irrelevant, and that China would go through a kind of color revolution, the way that we have seen the United States, you know, pursue these in other countries, and that would allow China to become a subordinate part of the global capitalist system centered on the United States. But that was never going to happen. That was never China's intention, or you know, they were certainly aware of that danger and did everything they could to avoid that. And as China, by the beginning of the second decade of this century, became more self-confident, became a little more proactive, a little more assertive in its relationship with the rest of the world, resuming the kind of role in global affairs that it historically had played for many, many centuries, American elites turned against China. They said, well, they're not going to join us, so we have to find a way to stop them. We have to find a way to slow down their progress, to, if possible, derail their development. And we get things like President Obama announcing the pivot to Asia, Secretary of State Clinton at that time calling for a new American Pacific century. And that only deepened under the Trump administration with the trade war that was launched, and now the Biden administration pursuing its own very hostile, very aggressive policies towards China. It's basically an issue of the United States fearing the loss of its power, its prestige, its privileges in global affairs, the dominant role it has played as a global hegemon for decades. That's ending, and they don't like that, and so they're trying to find ways to demonize and derail China.
Well, William, I mean, there are a lot of economic relations between the United States and China. I mean, one of the reasons it was said that some American officials were going to Beijing was actually to talk about this, basically this coexistence that they both need to have. So what happened to all of this in the middle of what we're seeing right now and all of a sudden this package being approved?
Well, it's that initiative is not over by any means, although the initiative was not enough to try to end the crisis between the United States and China, which really came to a tipping point with the visit of Pelosi to Taiwan. Both sides are interested in having these high-level dialogues, but China has made it very clear that it's not simply that we will talk. It's if you want a real relationship, there has to be mutual respect. There has to be win-win cooperation. There has to be a willingness to listen to the other side and to take concern to its core interests, one of which, of course, is Taiwan. The United States has not changed its policy officially. It's still reiterated most recently by Secretary Blinken in his meetings in Beijing and also by President Biden. Nevertheless, on the ground, what is happening is that there's an attempt to bring Taiwan somehow into the mix of a defense strategy, which is motivated primarily by the U.S. reaction to the success of the Belt and Road Initiative, which has really brought China to the center of world stage and created a lot of goodwill within the global South. This, more than anything else, has been the primary concern of the United States with regard to China's rise, if you will call it that. And that therefore they're taking every measure to defend against this, not by breaking with the policy of the One China, but by effectively undermining it by trying to arm Taiwan as a fortress in an overall containment strategy, which is aimed at China. And if they go too far with this, this will lead to conflict. At the present moment, there's a certain understanding of that, not by all the parties, and we are in a very tenuous situation, which reminds one, you know, very much of what happened just before the Ukraine crisis. Mm-hmm. And the decision by Russia to move into Ukraine.
Right. Well, Ken, is it possible that there is a divide between the State Department and the Pentagon in the way that the U.S. should deal with China? Or is this just part of a game or strategy? Because, again, we saw American officials go to Beijing and talk about improving ties. And then on the other hand, we see this package, this weapons package, and so many other things going on that has been approved. So is there a divide or not, you think?
Well, I'm not sure that there's necessarily a divide between the State Department and the Pentagon, although certainly the Pentagon is very interested in anything that enhances its influence and its prestige and its ability to, you know, deploy its assets and get more resources constantly, trying to draw more assets to itself. But I think what we've seen has been a pattern of not just rivalry or differences of opinion between maybe separate institutions, but even within the State Department, within the White House. We see one thing being said one day and then something completely different, indeed often totally opposite, being done the next day. Secretary of State Blinken goes to Beijing and reiterates the commitment of the United States to the One China policy and talks about getting conversations going and getting the relationship back on a better pattern. And the next day, President Biden denounces Xi Jinping as a dictator and characterizes China again in this sort of demonic mode. We see, the visit of Kerry, John Kerry, the visit of Janet Yellen. These touted as efforts to get the dialogue going again. And then we have this action of turning around and ramping up arms sales, arms deliveries to Taiwan, and furthering the rhetoric of supporting Taiwan independence.
So why do you think that we're seeing this difference? What's going on in your perspective?
Yeah, no, I think we're seeing very much a difference. And I think that it's what William said is that the United States is not actually willing to break with its relationship with China. The relationship between the countries economically is so profound that it would be devastating to the United States as well as very harmful to China. So they want to put pressure on China. They want to try and force China to maybe devote resources to military activity that otherwise they might devote to further improving the lives of their people, a strategy that they played out against the Soviet Union back in the 1980s with great effect. But that's not going to work because China is already at a much more advanced stage of economic development and much more capable not only of pursuing its own course of improvement, but also, as William was saying, sharing with other countries through initiatives like the Belt and Road. It has a much broader base of international support as well.
Well, William, China has repeatedly said that Taiwan is a part of China and the island is its red line. So let's talk about that. What do you think that means when it says it's its red line?
Well, it means that the post-war situation which was established, the international situation which was created, the structure that was created after World War II, included the fact that the areas that had been occupied by Japan prior to the war and during the war would then be returned to their rightful owners, if you want to put it that way. And in this case, Taiwan was recognized as a part of China, which it had been, for centuries. When the split came and the KMT ended up on the island of Taiwan, the U.S. played a different game since the KMT was calling itself the real representatives of China. The U.S. supported that. But still, considering the fact that Taiwan was a part of China, which the KMT said it was. Later on, however, as China grew, not only economically, but in terms of its political influence, there was more of an attempt to use Taiwan as a hedge against China in the rim, in the Pacific Rim region. Most recently, of course, you have the alliances that are being set up with Japan, with AUKUS, with Australia, trying to get other countries like the Philippines to some extent on board. And Taiwan is a key issue. Most recently, there was a member of the Pentagon, Assistant Secretary of the Pentagon, Ratner, at a hearing where he said that Taiwan represents one of the most important elements in the U.S. defense strategy. Taiwan, of course, is about 100 miles or so off the coast of China, probably as close as Puerto Rico to the United States. And therefore, if the U.S. could use this as a starting point for moves against China, this would be very dangerous in military terms. So that there are two things that are involved there. One is the historical legitimacy of Taiwan being a part of China, which is being insisted upon by the leadership in Beijing. And there's also the defense relationship that if they get if the U.S. has a defense position on the island of Taiwan, it would be like China having a defense position in Puerto Rico. And that would be absolutely unacceptable.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ken, William has just talked about the various alliances that the United States is attempting along with its allies and also with the NATO spreading east and dealing with Japan. Tell me about how that affects the whole situation and how do you think that China will have to deal with that?
Well, the United States obviously is trying to bolster its position in the Western Pacific. It's attempting, and not just attempting, it's carrying out a campaign of encircling China, expanding its bases, ramping up its troops, its military deployments in that whole area. This goes right along with the pivot to Asia that Obama announced back in 2011. They're getting Japan to embark upon a course of rearmament, which goes against the fundamental commitments that were made by Japan after the end of World War II. They're carrying out actions like this visit of a nuclear-armed submarine to South Korea, which is a direct provocation both to the DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea in the north, and to China. And they're encouraging NATO, and of course it's NATO expansion, this relentless move to the east since the collapse of the Soviet Union. It's NATO expansion that has led directly to the war in Ukraine. And now they're trying to push a kind of a neo-NATO expansion into East Asia and Southeast Asia. So this is part of this very, you know, kind of desperate effort by the United States to shore up its position, to maintain its dominant role, to continue to treat the Pacific and the countries around the Pacific as if they're the natural extension of American power, a sort of sphere of influence. They see the Pacific kind of as an American lake, and they want to hang on to that. And so they're trying to shore up these alliances, bolster these defense, as they call it, these military commitments, carry out these kinds of really very provocative actions in the hope that will intimidate China or cause China to back off its international posture. And that's simply not going to happen. China is very committed to not only developing its own economy and enhancing the livelihoods of its people, but to providing that kind of assistance to other countries that don't want to be dominated by the United States, don't want to just be incorporated in an American-centered global system. And so things like the BRI or developing other kinds of international institutions to get out from under American domination, I think that's the path that China will really pursue. They don't want to be drawn into some sort of direct confrontation with mm-hmm. the United States. They want to go about their business. And I think that's how they will try to pursue this current situation.
Well, William, is the U.S. trying to use Taiwan as it used Ukraine for expanding its own agenda while sacrificing the population, putting them at risk?
Well, that's the case that that exists today. And of course, the Chinese are very much aware of this. There's now a recent exchange of students between the People's Republic and Taiwan and vice versa, which has been mediated by Ma Ying-jeou, who's former head of the KMT, to try and create the kind of people-to-people exchanges which did exist after 1992, after the agreement with Taiwan on the one country, two systems perspective. And they're trying to revive that again. And I think this will be somewhat successful because I think the people in Taiwan feel that they are victims in this and do not want a confrontation because they will be on the front lines of this. Nevertheless, the leadership of the DPP, which still has strong support, as we can see from the polls coming up in the next election, is playing the U.S. card to the hilt. The U.S. is doing whatever it can to try and support this, short of simply abandoning the One China policy. And at a certain point, that can lead to a confrontation. I agree with the former speaker that that's not what China wants to do. That's what they would like to avoid. But there are red lines here. They have said clearly, Declaration of Independence, that is a red line. And I would think that also, to the extent that the United States can build up a defensive wall in Taiwan to prevent an attack by the PRC, I think there would also be a decision made that if they felt this was the last opportunity, there would also be a move in that direction. But I think that the general attitude of the Chinese is that they have international support for the One China policy and generally for their policy with regard to this community of shared interests, which President Xi has been talking about. The global South, which is the global majority, is behind that. The question is, can they mobilize that opinion in such a way to change the chessboard that has now been set up for them, you know, by the U.S. policy?
Well, Kent, it was mentioned that much of this has to do with this change in the world order from the unipolar world to multipolar world, the U.S. losing its reign as the hegemon. So let's look at it from that perspective. Now, William just said that China definitely does not want war, and they would try to do their best to avoid that. What about Washington? If Washington feels so desperate that they're losing this, if we want to say, reign as the number one global power, do you think that we have certain parts of the society or rulers of that society that are willing to do whatever it takes, even if it means war or whatever, just to try to hold on to power, that they think that that's the only way they could do that? How do you see it?
Well, I think that that's a very real danger. I think that, you know, certainly the political rhetoric that comes out of Washington on both sides of the mainstream political perspective, it doesn't matter in Congress if you're a Republican or a Democrat, you know, everyone, there seems to be this is one of the few items of bipartisan agreement in Congress that we should be hostile towards China. And if anything, the only rivalry between the parties is which one can be more, can talk tougher and be more macho in the rhetoric about China. And this is a very, very dangerous situation. The kinds of practical activities that the United States is carrying out, the provocations in the South China Sea, the provocations around Taiwan, you know, threatening these sending American warships through the strait, things like that, sending more weapons, sending military advisors to the island. These are all actions, and actions, as we often say here, speak louder than words. So the public rhetorical commitment to retaining the One China policy is one thing. But, you know, when we look at the actual conduct of the American government, it's very, very dangerous. And I fear that there are those either in Congress or in the Pentagon or in the White House who may not really fully understand the seriousness of the danger, the dangerous activities in which they're engaging. China does, as William said, China has red lines. Trying to actually separate Taiwan from China, trying to declare Taiwan to be independent, would be one of those red lines, and that could lead to a conflict, an actual military conflict, which would first and foremost be devastating for Taiwan, would be harmful for China, but would also be extremely harmful for the American economy, because our economies, China and the United States, are so deeply interconnected. I don't think that the politicians who are spouting this kind of rhetoric are taking a serious enough effort to understand just how this world today is organized and how it works, because they're flirting with what could be a very, very disastrous outcome for all the peoples involved.
Well, William, just a minute. I have 1 minute or less, actually. Where do you see this going, your prognosis of the near future of Washington-Beijing relations?
Well, I think they probably will continue with the high-level meetings. I certainly hope so. There will be a lot of rhetoric and a lot of things being done, especially in the U.S. Congress, to provoke China. I think that the attitude of the administration and basically is to try and avoid a conflict. President Biden probably is in charge, although he's aging rapidly, and question is if he's really in charge or if it's young Turks that are calling the shots. But I think there, and hope that there is enough sense in administration circles to realize where those red lines are. And in spite of the provocations, that they use whatever communications they set up with the Chinese to try and crisis manage, if nothing better, the situation so that it doesn't lead to a military conflict.
And on that note, thank you both for being with me. Ken Hammond, Professor of East Asian and Global History, New Mexico State University. And William Jones, Washington Bureau Chief Executive Intelligence Review. Thank you both for being with me. And thank you for joining us for another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein عليه السلام in dialogue.
صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the son of the commander of the faithful Imam Ali, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, the grandson of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards patience and fortitude. The one who has eloquently said, "Be aware that all good works bear praise, and they bear commendation and bring about a good reward." Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his dialogues.
Every clean soul
Imam al-Hussein's words addressing Amr al-Ka'bi. Yes, you are going ahead of me in paradise. Pay my salam to the Prophet of Allah and inform him that I will follow soon.
As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdillah wa ala al-arwah allati halat bifina'i alayka.
Dear audience, now let's listen to some parts of Ziyara al-Nahiya al-Muqaddasa. Stay tuned.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. السلام على الحسين الذي سمحت نفسه بمهجته.
Peace be upon al-Hussein, who sacrificed himself up to the last drops of the blood of his heart.
As-salamu ala man ata'a Allah fi sirrihi wa alaniyatihi.
Peace be upon him who obeyed Allah secretly and openly.
As-salamu ala man ja'ala Allah shifa'a fi turbatihi.
Peace be upon whom Allah placed a cure in the soul of his place of martyrdom.
As-salamu ala man al-ijabatu tahta qubbatihi.
Peace be upon the one under whose dome answer to supplications is guaranteed.
As-salamu ala man al-a'immatu min dhurriyatihi.
Peace be upon the one in whose descendants are the imams after him.
As-salamu ala ibn khatim al-anbiya. As-salamu ala ibn sayyid al-awsiya.
Peace be upon the son of the seal of the prophets. Peace be upon the son of the chief of the executors.
As-salamu ala ibn Fatimah al-Zahra. As-salamu ala ibn Khadijah al-Kubra.
Peace be upon the son of Fatima, the radiant. Peace be upon the son of Khadija, the great.
As-salamu ala ibn Sidrat al-Muntaha. As-salamu ala ibn Jannat al-Ma'wa. As-salamu ala ibn Zamzam wa-Safa.
Peace be upon the son of the lotus tree in the outermost boundary of heaven. Peace be upon the son of the garden of refuge. Peace be upon the son of Zamzam and As-Safa.
As-salamu ala al-Murammal bid-Dima. السلام على المهتوك الخباء السلام على خامس أصحاب أهل الكسايا.
Peace be upon him who was saturated in his blood. Peace be upon him whose tents were violated. Peace be upon the fifth of the people of the cloak.
Look what Karbala gave us. In return, what can we give? I thought I'd go there to die, but in fact I went there to live.
You cannot die. You cannot die. You are alive and I won't stop believing that I may die. You live on even though we're left grieving. And I will walk on the roads you would walk. Your words live on though you no longer.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the dialogues of the Master of Martyrs, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. We find in this dialogue that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam had with Amr al-Ka'bi that here too Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam gives Amr the good tidings and the good news of paradise. And along with this glad tidings of paradise, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam requests Amr to send his salams to the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi. And so here, dear friends, we learn of two things. One, Amr bin al-Qurayza al-Ka'bi was one of those individuals who had been heavily wounded by arrows at the time when Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions were praying the Salah. And so we learn the great importance of Salah, but we understand one other thing from this dialogue of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and that is that the Messenger of Allah sallallahu